This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. American citizenship comes with certain privileges, most of the time. Millions of Americans cannot vote in national elections, do not have full congressional representation, and are not eligible for a lot of federal aid. They are the residents of U.S. territories, including the biggest one, Puerto Rico. And on Sunday, Puerto Ricans voted overwhelmingly to support becoming the 51st state in a special referendum. But less than a quarter of registered voters there cast ballots. What's behind this referendum? And why did most Puerto Rican voters sit it out? Let's discuss it with Julio Ricardo Varela, the co-host of the political podcast In the Thick. He's also a contributor to the NPR program Latino USA. Julio, welcome to 1A.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Joining us by phone from Puerto Rico is Rafael Cox Alomar, a law professor at the University of the District of Columbia. Professor Alomar, welcome.
Thank you so much, Joshua. It's a pleasure to be here.
Julio Varela, let me start with you. What brought on this special election in the first place? How did we get to this point?
That's a great question. Well, you know, it actually started from 2012. So what happened in 2012, there was another status plebiscite that was actually done the same day as the gubernatorial race. So it actually was the first time ever in the history of Puerto Rico that the current Commonwealth is going to come. Colonial is going to come.
It's going to come up. It's all right. Yeah,
The current territorial status was rejected.
And I should say that plebiscite is the technical term for this kind of vote.
Yeah, the plebiscite's a vote. And then the second part of that vote said, if you rejected the current territorial status, what would you choose? Statehood, associated free state, or independence? Statehood won in the low 60s. Now, that was a non-binding plebiscite that went to Congress. And again, what happened in that second part is that about 500,000 people left it blank. So even though statehood won like 61%, a lot of people who were probably for the current territorial status or didn't know what they wanted just didn't vote. So it kind of sent a mixed message to Congress. And what President Obama did was he designated $2.5 million for another plebiscite that would happen later. And the $2.5 million was going to be used with federal money. And it was going to be used to sort of give a little bit of education about the plebiscite and also give, for the first time in the history of Puerto Rico, what I like to call federal juice. In the fact that it was going to be the first time that even the next plebiscite might not be binding, at least by having federal money in the system, that the federal government would say, like, all right, we're kind of involved here.
Right.
Now, fast forward, just like in the United States, every 4 years, Puerto Rico elects a governor. So when the Americans are electing a president in Puerto Rico, there's a big gubernatorial race. And last time around, the pro-statehood governor candidate was Ricardo Rosselló, who ran and won. He defeated the Commonwealth candidate. And this was happening during a time of the debt crisis. I know people have talked about it, and we're going to talk about that, but I'm really trying to focus on the plebiscite. So
right.
Anyway, he made a promise. This was sort of Ricardo Rosselló's promise of to say that there would be a plebiscite. And his promise, which was very interesting, was that it would be the first time that the plebiscite would be statehood or independence. And that's the way it was set up until April. And the reason why I bring the $2.5 million up is that the Department of Justice then sends a letter to the Rosselló administration and says, we're not going to give you the $2.5 million to approve this plebiscite because we don't agree with the language of the ballot. So they had to put back the Commonwealth status again into the ballot, which basically brings you back to 2012.
So let me make sure I'm following all the moving parts
here. It's so complicated.
And I want to make sure we don't leave anyone behind. It sounds like what you're saying is that in 2012, there was a vote, a non-binding vote about what Puerto Ricans wanted to do, whether they wanted to maintain their status, try to become a state, or go independent, become basically a sovereign nation. And they voted at that time for statehood. They voted this time for statehood. But the vote this time around, it sounds like the federal government had a different stake in because they had concerns about the validity of the ballot item, of the wording.
Right, because if they were going to release the $2.5 million to educate, it would have been a stamp of approval. So basically, It's exactly right. And important thing about 2012, what's really important, and we are going to talk about it, is that it was the first time in the history of Puerto Rico that there was a question that said, do you approve or reject the current territorial status? And most of the people rejected it. It was the first time in the history of Puerto Rico.
Let me ask Professor Rafael Cox Salomar about the current state of affairs. Explain what it means, legally speaking, for Puerto Rico to be a territory. What does that mean in terms of its relationship to the federal government, citizens' relationship with mainland America? Just break it down for us legally, basically. What does territorial status actually mean?
Well, thank you for the question. First of all, Puerto Rico remains, since 1898, an unincorporated territory of the U.S., as the U.S. Supreme Court itself has actually acknowledged as recently as June of last year in the Sánchez Valle case. What does that mean? That means that Puerto Rico is a territory in perpetuity. It's basically a territory where Congress has made no promise of statehood. It's a territory where the Constitution doesn't follow the flag. In other words, technically speaking, only those fundamental rights identified by the U.S. Supreme Court apply to Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico was granted a degree of self-government in 1952. That's the famous Commonwealth Arrangement, whereby the people of Puerto Rico drafted a constitution that was later to be validated by Congress. And nowadays, we are in a situation where, pursuant to the PROMESA legislation, the local government of Puerto Rico has lost whatever little track it had, whatever little autonomy it had, to actually articulate policies in order to solve Puerto Rican problems. So we are back in the 1900s. Basically, we are back at a time where you have a board that's unelected, that doesn't go through the advice and consent muster of the Senate in Washington, just appointed by the president on the basis of a series of nominations made by the leadership in Congress. And those folks are the ones who really rule Puerto Rico pursuant to plenary authority granted to them by Congress. So that's basically what's going on. And the word to describe this anomalous situation is fundamentally colonial.
Well, I do want to get more into that as we continue our conversation about Puerto Rico and its push for possibly statehood with law professor Rafael Cox Alomar of the University of the District of Columbia, journalist Julio Ricardo Varela, and with you. What questions and thoughts do you have about Puerto Rico's current state as it relates to the United States? Should Congress allow Puerto Rico to become the 51st state? Should it become sovereign, basically its own nation? Should it remain the way it is? What do you think? Please email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Professor Alomar, you mentioned this piece of legislation called PROMESA, which is related to Puerto Rico's debt crisis and the system for trying to resolve it, this board that was appointed and sits in New York to try to figure out the debt crisis. How did Puerto Rico get to that point financially?
Well, basically, Puerto Rico, as you may know, is the third issuer of municipal debt in the U.S. after California and New York. We have a heavy load of debt. And when I say we, I mean the government of Puerto Rico. So basically, the ratio of public debt to GDP is over 103%. I mean, Puerto Rico says debt, if you add up the pension, the retirement system, and the public health system, it's something beyond perhaps $120-140 billion. I mean, it's huge. It's a massive load of debt. We have a series of debt issuers. I mean, not just the government of Puerto Rico, but, you know, public corporations, municipalities. I mean, a whole host of debt issuers. Our local governments have been irresponsible, right, in issuing debt that we cannot actually shoulder in light of our revenues. We have been less efficient in competing vis-a-vis our neighbors in the Caribbean and other places. Obviously, we had a series of comparative advantages in terms of tax loopholes and ways in which we used to attract foreign investment into Puerto Rico that has just gone by the wayside in light of NAFTA, CAFTA, free trade, the WTO, so forth, so on. So Puerto Rico says, tools for competing effectively have been actually weakened, and really we do not control our economic policy, our monetary policy. I mean, everything is basically controlled by Congress, and Congress really has shown itself disinterested in addressing Puerto Rican issues in a forthright manner. I mean, the debt crisis will not be solved just on the basis of austerity, as we learned in the European case. The debt crisis in Puerto Rico and the economic malaise afflicting Puerto Rico necessarily requires the articulation of a new economic strategy. So Puerto Rico really needs a new economic strategy.
Right, and I do want to get into that, Professor, with regard to the economic strategy. We're up against a break in just a moment. But a number of our listeners have been asking about the federal government's role in all this. For instance, Reed emailed, "I understand much of Puerto Rico's industry was incentivized by the U.S. and that the current economic woes on the island are due to those subsidies being withdrawn. If that's the case, doesn't the United States bear some responsibility in Puerto Rico's recovery? This seems like the last of old world colonialism rearing its ugly head." Plenty of questions, just like Reed's, that we need to get to before this hour is up. As we talk about the future of Puerto Rico with Julio Ricardo Varela, the co-host of In the Thick and a contributor to Latino USA, and Professor Rafael Cox Alomar of the University of the District of Columbia. In just a moment, we'll add a few more voices to the conversation, and we'll keep going with your questions and thoughts. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. People born in Puerto Rico are U.S. citizens. But a poll last year found that 2 out of 5 Americans didn't know that. Folks on the mainland don't really talk much about what's happening in the territories like Guam and American Samoa or the Northern Mariana Islands or the U.S. Virgin Islands. This limited status is a sore spot for many in Puerto Rico, including its governor, Ricardo Rosselló, as he recently told Al Jazeera.
The world has all but eradicated colonial territories. So it is a shameful status, in my view. It is one that inhibits the growth of Puerto Rico, so it shouldn't move forward.
That's Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló. How does America's status as a territorial power affect the power of American democracy? We're discussing it today with Rafael Cox Alomar, a professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia, and Julio Varela, co-host of the political podcast In the Thick and a contributor to Latino USA. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. We'll add a few more voices to the conversation, but first I want to get briefly to this question I read before the break. Reed emailed us, "I understand much of Puerto Rico's industry was incentivized by the U.S. and that the current economic woes on the island are due to those subsidies being withdrawn. If that's the case, doesn't the United States bear some responsibility in Puerto Rico's recovery? This seems like the last of old world colonialism rearing its ugly head." Julio, how much responsibility do you think the U.S. bears for Puerto Rico's current financial situation and for recovering from it, briefly?
Just as much, right? So people just need to look at Section 936, which were tax breaks that happened in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And I think a lot of people don't know that those tax breaks went away during the 90s between a deal between Democrats and Republicans. And once they started going away in the middle of the odds, like, that's when the real rubber hit the road. Professor Cox is absolutely correct. It's not only U.S. Subsidies. It is the irresponsibility of the political leadership of the island for continuing to spend and spend and spend. So it's kind of this perfect storm that happened. Once your industry left, there was nothing to replace those industries. And that's a big issue in Puerto Rico right now. Also considering the fact that you have a bilingual, bicultural workforce who are American citizens, and most of the brain power is getting on a flight to JetBlue and going to, you know, Florida or other places around the United States where they're getting paid for these bilingual jobs. So you're not only seeing a lack of industry because the subsidies have gone away, you've seen sort of the brain drain. And it's really hypocritical of the United States federal government to kind of say, not my problem. And that kind of speaks into, just to bring back the plebiscite on Sunday, when you bring up Governor Rosselló, there's a lot of Puerto Ricans who will say, yes, the current status is shameful. I don't think they're going to get a lot of people, unless, you know, Professor Coxon, you can correct me, but unless you're a really old school Commonwealth supporter, there's not a lot of people on the island or in the mainland who are saying, you know what, our current situation is fantastic. Mm-hmm. So what's happened is, here's another effort where the Puerto Rico, Governor Rosselló had a very, very amazing opportunity for the first time in the history of Puerto Rico to get the federal government involved in a plebiscite that would have at least had more people involved. But what happened is it was pushed too quickly. The governor of Puerto Rico did not want to work with the federal government, and that's been chronicled. I wrote about it in Latino USA and other places. And what's happened is that it just creates the typical, and again, Professor Cox, he ran for resident commissioner, so he can speak to this as well, mm-hmm. the typical infighting on the island between statehooders and commonwealthers, which makes Republicans and Democrats look like a party compared to what's gone on.
Well, you know, there's a lot of our listeners certainly believe that something has to be done, and that Congress should perhaps be more active in this. Peter wrote on our website, the1a.org, the economic situation in Puerto Rico seems similar to that in Greece. Perhaps Congress and Puerto Ricans can learn what to do and what not to do from the EU experience. And Robert wrote on our Facebook page, in or out, it's way past time. Colonialism has no place in the 21st century. Let's add a few more voices to our conversation. Joining us now is Natasha Licia Ora Banon. She is the president of the National Lawyers Guild and associate counsel with Latino Justice Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, also known as PERLDEF. Natasha, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Also joining us is Professor Charles Benator, who teaches as Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Connecticut. Professor Benator, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha, let me start with you. How is the current state of affairs affecting day-to-day life in Puerto Rico? Paint us a picture of what life is like there now.
It's pretty grim. You know, Julio spoke a little bit about the austerity measures and, you know, briefly touched on it. When you talk about the economic crisis, which, as your guests have rightly discussed, has a political origin, it doesn't come out of an isolated context. Beyond the economic decision making, there's the political relationship is at the heart of why there's an economic crisis, because there's a political one, and that manifests in the daily lives of all Puerto Ricans, regardless of what your political affiliation or beliefs are. There have been deep austerity measures that have been imposed since two prior administrations, really since Governor Fortuño's, when you saw the austerity measures really begin to deepen. And we've seen, as one of your, comments on the Facebook page mentioned, you know, that this is something we've seen around the world and in Greece and other places where austerity is clearly not the solution to an economic crisis. And yet you have, you know, upwards of nearly 200 public schools that are going to be closed, half of the budget of the University of Puerto Rico that's being proposed to be cut, a university that has 11 campuses, that is the kind of flagship of public education, higher education, responsible for educating most of Puerto Ricans who've gone on to university on the island and beyond. You have cuts, serious cuts to healthcare, and the healthcare crisis is really looming, and we haven't even had a chance to really get into that. But also, you know, the inability to service emergency vehicles, mm-hmm. to service parts of hospital wings, dealing with infrastructure. I mean, this is the increase in taxes and sales taxes, and so the brunt of the economic crisis is being passed on to those with the least ability to afford it and to pay for it, and not for those who are responsible for contributing and creating this.
Let me come to you, Associate Professor Charles Benator Santiago. Talk about some of the history of this debate in Congress. How long have U.S. lawmakers been debating Puerto Rico status, and how has that debate evolved? Has it always, and I'm just looking for a condensed history, but has it always been kind of disinterested? Oh, that's cute. You want to be a state. Okay, thanks for coming to D.C. Make sure you see them all before you leave. Or has anyone really taken this seriously?
Well, you know, it's a complicated question, but in sum, the debates over the territorial status were essentially resolved, in terms of the territorial status, between 1900 and 1952. Congress progressively enacted legislation granting different types of territorial autonomy without changing the status of the island. So by 1952, Congress had pretty much settled on that question. On the question of the status, Congress has debated upwards of 132 bills and plebiscite options and referendum options, describing a whole range of status options. But it's never approved a single bill or a single law allowing for Puerto Ricans to choose among different options or status options. Whereas in Puerto Rico, there have been five plebiscites since 1967 that try to grapple a little bit with different status options. But these, again, have been local political debates.
Let me get to a number of our questions from our listeners. Our listeners have some very good questions. First of all, just a little bit more basic background. We talked about the fact that Puerto Ricans are American citizens. They do have voting rights, though not necessarily in federal elections. Gerard asked via email, do Puerto Ricans pay federal taxes? Professor Cox-Alomar, do Puerto Ricans pay federal taxes?
Puerto Ricans do pay payroll taxes, okay? Puerto Ricans do not pay income tax on the income they derive from Puerto Rico sources, but Puerto Ricans do pay Social Security tax, Medicaid tax. I mean, Puerto Ricans do pay payroll taxes, and this is one of the urban myths that Puerto Ricans, oh, those guys, they don't pay anything. No, they do pay. They do pay payroll taxes, but they do receive less Medicare than folks in the States, although they pay equal amount of payroll taxes.
Ethan asks, is there a precedent for any other state applying for and being granted statehood while under such economic distress? Is this unprecedented?
And the answer is, there's no such precedent. If you look at the 37 territories that acceded to statehood after the initial 13 colonies, they were doing well financially. I mean, this is one of the major obstacles the statehood camp faces in trying to persuade Congress to grant admission to the Union to Puerto Rico as a state. Definitely, yes. That's a big, big challenge.
And that might speak to another question from a listener, because I think, you're right, Professor, I think about other states that became states. They became states because it was in the benefit of the federal union to admit them. California became a state in 1850. Gold was discovered in 1848. So to that point... Exactly. A total coincidence. So to that point, one of our listeners asked, what is the practical justification in admitting Puerto Rico? I just see no benefit for the U.S. whatsoever for admitting them as the 51st state. Natasha, can you speak... let me start with you, Julio, then. Can you speak to what some of the argument is for why it would benefit the United States of America to make Puerto Rico the 51st state?
Yeah, no, I would just... The biggest one that the governor is currently saying, and it's a really, really hot political topic, is that it could become the bridge to the Americas, right? That's what the statehood party is saying, that you have this bilingual, bicultural, educated workforce that understands U.S. culture and understands Latin American culture, and it could become sort of this bridge in this new global economy. But that, to be honest with you, goes against everything that you're hearing from the current Republican administration of President Donald Trump, where it's all this make America great again and we need to kind of be more isolationist. So it's a really, really tough dichotomy here, because what is the strategic value of Puerto Rico now in 2017? And if the economic value is not being pushed that way, and you have a Republican administration that says, you know, we're actually trying to close ranks on America, why are we going to add more people on the rolls? It just feels like a real uphill battle. But I didn't want to interrupt Natasha I apologize.
Well, and Natasha, I'm wondering also, how much would statehood actually open a wider door toward Puerto Rico being a gateway to Latin America? I mean, I think we already kind of have a strong gateway to Latin America in Miami-Dade County. That is a gateway to all of Latin America, and all of Latin America is
and
in
New
Miami.
York City.
And New York City, yeah. Exactly. So what are we really missing out on with Puerto Rico by having it as a territory rather than a state?
I'll get to that point in just a second. I want to mention, you know, if anyone who thinks that Puerto Rico is going to be the gateway to Latin America, ask Hawaii if they think they're the gateway to, you know, the Asian Pacific. I mean, that's not what happens when you become a state, right? Your culture gets eradicated. And I think that the question perhaps is the wrong question to ask, not what benefit does America derive, but what behooves the people of Puerto Rico? What benefit do they derive? I mean, if the relationship with the United States has proven anything, it's been disastrous. Look at this unprecedented economic crisis that the island finds itself in. This is the result of the political relationship that it has with the United States. That doesn't go away simply because you grant statehood, despite the fact that we've been told that. I mean, I think many people agree with the rhetoric of the governor in terms of being a colony is not a dignified status for any nation. It violates international law and principles. The United Nations has spoken repeatedly over three decades about this issue. And he's right. It is not a dignified status and is not one that anyone should accept. We differ on what the results should be. And statehood is not an economic solution. And for many of us, it's not a political solution. And the question shouldn't be, what does America want? It should be, what do the people of Puerto Rico want and deserve? And what is a legitimate process of decolonization, which is not a plebiscite, which I call an opinion poll, right? Besides the fact that it's non-binding, it doesn't the way that it's carried out is not in accordance with what international law and principles subscribe. And that's the real question. What does a legitimate, verifiable process of decolonization look like for the people of Puerto Rico to decide their own economic and political future?
Well, then, Professor Venator Santiago, let me put that question to you. What about independence? You know, Natasha mentioned the eradication of culture and identity. And there is that very strong possibility that it's the reality. If Puerto Rico becomes the 51st state, it is now fully subject to the federal government. And that will subsume more of Puerto Rico's unique, vibrant, rich, gorgeous culture to American culture. And it may or may not survive the transition. What is the argument for independence for Puerto Rico?
If you don't mind, let me make one prior comment before answering that on the economic question. The first thing, I think it's really important to remember that the pro-statehood government in Puerto Rico believed for the past 30, maybe 40 years, that the best way to achieve statehood is by creating an economic crisis of such magnitude that it will force Congress to act. The current governor's father actually pushed to eliminate Section 936 as a way to create a financial crisis that could somehow persuade Congress to grant
right, but we can argue. I mean, not to get too in the weeds, Professor, we have to really come together as Puerto Ricans to understand that the political class from both parties have been at fault at this, and that's our problem. When we start pitting estadistas against rojos, and we need to start looking at this more holistically. So it's a question of trying to look at the longer economic thing and say, you know, the party of the debt. There's many populares, the popular party, that are making money off this debt crisis, just as many estadistas, statehood people, are making money off this debt crisis. Not to be disrespectful, but we need to get beyond that type of thinking.
Well, but I think, Professor Venator Santiago, I think I do kind of take your point in that the politics around all this have kind of shifted the playing field a lot, and that there is something to be said for stacking the deck one way or the other, particularly the concerns about maybe the phrasing of this vote and the $2.5 million that we're going to go into it. We're up against a break very shortly, but Professor, can you talk about what the one strongest argument for Puerto Rican independence often is? Like, what's the argument that comes up all the time, briefly?
Well, the dominant argument is a nationalist argument, but there are alternative arguments that suggest that you can gain access to democracy and to global markets, and the possibility of defining your own democratic society without being bound to an undemocratic constitution or to colonialism. So the idea is the openness that would allow Puerto Rico to insert itself into global markets and a global society.
Well, a number of our listeners say that if Puerto Rico wants to have more representation from Congress, it needs to get in line. Sarah wrote on our Facebook page, please don't forget about the need for statehood right here in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The citizens of D.C. pay higher per capita federal taxes than any state, and we lack full voting rights and legislative autonomy. Let's make D.C. the 51st state, and then we'll discuss the 52nd. Time for a break. We'll continue our conversation about Puerto Rico. DC's a whole nother conversation, which I'm sure we'll have one day. But when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the future of Puerto Rico with Julio Varela of In the Thick and Latino USA, Natasha Alicia Orabanan of Latino Justice Pearl Def, Associate Professor Charles Venator Santiago of the University of Connecticut, and Professor Rafael Cox Alomar of the University of the District of Columbia. Keep your questions and thoughts coming, 1A@WAMU.org. And we'll continue in a moment. Stay close. Let's continue our conversation about the future of Puerto Rico with Charles Benator Santiago, a political scientist at the University of Connecticut, attorney Natasha Licia Orabanan, Rafael Cox Alomar, a professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia, and Julio Varela, a journalist and co-host of the political podcast In the Thick and a contributor to the NPR magazine Latino USA. Let's talk a little bit more about the statehood option. Congressman Jose Serrano, who represents the Bronx in New York and is Puerto Rican, released a statement yesterday. Part of his statement reads, quote, "While there was a lower voter turnout in this referendum when compared to past elections and referenda on the island, let's be clear. Voter turnout was in part lower because of an unnecessary and cynical boycott. Now Puerto Rico needs to come before Congress to ask for a change in status. In democracies, the will of the voters is respected, and Congress has a duty to listen and act upon these results so that Puerto Rico can be decolonized once and for all. As I've said in the past, after hundreds of years as a territory, the United States owes the island and its millions of American citizens that much," end quote. Again, that's a statement read in part from Congressman Jose Serrano, who is Puerto Rican and represents the Bronx. I wonder, Natasha, who you see in Congress other than Congressman Serrano who might have enough clout to raise the profile of this cause. There's a lot going on in Washington right now, but who are the big allies as you see them?
I'm not sure that there are many allies.
I hear y'all laughing. Does that mean there are none?
Well, no, there are some. I'm looking at Natasha in the New York studio, and I'm waiting for the answer.
I don't know that I would say so much as allies. I mean, the three members of Congress who are Puerto Rican who openly talk about this issue also are split along the partisan lines in Puerto Rico. One is a supports the statehood option, one supports the current Commonwealth, and one supports independence. So they, on this particular issue, they're not necessarily aligned. And I don't think that they have a lot of ears listening to them in Congress around this issue. That is the nature of being a colony. It is absolutely invisible, and it's not deemed worthy of discussion.
Could we clarify this whole colony piece, by the way? Because I feel like that's a very sure. controversial aspect of it, calling Puerto Rico a colony rather than a territory. I know one of our listeners kind of sniped at me on Twitter for using the word colony in the promo for this show because it's unconstitutional to have a colony, and
it is unconstitutional to have a colony.
But let's be real. I think the professor, Professor Cox talked about it. People really need to do their, go read the last Supreme Court justice decisions about Puerto Rico. Go read the insular cases. You can call it a colony in the 19th century or a territory in the 20th century or a commonwealth in the late 20th century. But guess what, people? There is a one nation that controls another part of this world. And maybe, if you say, you could call it a colony in the 1776. But there are people that can't call Puerto Rico a colony now in 2017. I find that to be, if we're wordsmithing this, it's like this has a historical context, guys.
Well, and more than that, there's a legal connotation here, right? So the acquisition of other territories by the United States in 1898 was one of colonialism, right? That has not shifted in 119 years, despite the fact that we call it a territory. That's because under the territorial clause, the United States has exerted and tried to justify its possession of other lands and its acquisition of them. That did not change in 1952 when Puerto Rico got its own constitution and a new legal fiction was created called the Free Associated State. None of those are true. It is not free. It is not associated. It is not a state. That was simply to remove Puerto Rico from the list of colonized nations from the UN and to remove it from scrutiny from the international community because the international community had spoken clearly that colonialism is a violation of international law.
Well, let's back
up. Puerto Rico is a self-governing territory, which it's not.
Let's back up just 1 second and let's try to clarify this constitutional question. And Professor Rafael Cox Alomar, I would appreciate your read on this. When you, Natasha, referred to kind of the territories clause of the Constitution, we're talking about Article 4, Clause 2, the property clause. And it says, Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. And nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state, unquote. That's from Article 4 of the U.S. Constitution. Professor Cox Alomar, what's wrong with that? Is it doesn't that mean that it's okay constitutionally? It may not be okay morally or ethically. Set that aside for a second. Constitutionally, is it really constitutionally wrong for Puerto Rico to be a territory and be treated as such?
Well, the Constitution basically provides for the acquisition and disposition of territories. I mean, ever since the Peck case in 1810, Chief Justice Marshall was quite adamant in construing rather expansively the reach of Congress's authority, plenary authority, under the Territorial Clause. Now, the reason why the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia drafted a territorial clause was to basically empower the federal government with exclusive authority of what to do with the outlying territories out there to the west and to prevent states from bickering against each other. So that authority to decide what to do with non-state territory or territory that was actually disputed by the various states, that authority was actually granted to the federal government in order to prevent or to avert conflicts among the various states. Okay, so the U.S. Supreme Court has actually validated as recent as 2016, and even before that during the Boumediene case and other cases that arose out of the treatment of the Bush administration, right, of the illegal combatants in the Taliban and other Al-Qaeda, you know, etc. The Supreme Court has validated that indeed Congress has plenary authority over the territories. If you look at the PROMESA bill,
The bill to reform Puerto Rico's finances.
That's right, the bill that basically established the control board. I mean, Congress doesn't hide in explicitly suggesting at the beginning of the bill that it is acting upon its plenary authority under the territorial clause of the U.S. Constitution. Okay, so Congress has basically unhindered authority over Puerto Rico.
So then here's what I'm wondering about, and this kind of gets back to, I think, the comment that a number of our listeners made about Washington, D.C., including Sarah on Facebook, who wrote, "Don't forget about the need for statehood right here in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The citizens of D.C. pay higher per capita federal taxes than any state, and we lack full voting rights and legislative autonomy. Let's make D.C. the 51st state, then discuss the 52nd. It occurs to me that if the American people are not fired up about the taxation without representation license plates that are all over Washington, and about the fact that the federal government refuses to fund, you know, Metro Rail here in Washington to the point where the red line doesn't freak out every 3 days, then it's not a very strong case to make that a territory, which is nowhere near as central to the operation of the United States, should come first. It just doesn't sound like a compelling argument to the average American that is far more concerned about what happens in Washington than in Puerto Rico. Natasha, I wonder if you could put something to an American who thinks that way. What's something that folks who think that way maybe just are not aware of that might shake their perspective?
You know what? I think that we need to be careful. This is the nuance piece, right? To compare Puerto Rico with Greece or Argentina or Detroit, for example, around the economic crisis, or to compare it to D.C., misses what we've been talking about, which is the fact that Puerto Rico is a colony, right? We're not talking merely about a people that don't have full representation in Congress. We're talking about the systemic eradication and expropriation of land and of a people and of a culture and of a language, the imposition of an economic and political model over another nation. That is different from Greece or Argentina, which are sovereign nations and have the ability to decide how they want to respond to their economic crisis in accordance with their own values and principles, that have their own democracy. That's different from Detroit, that has political representation. D.C. has an issue, a justifiable issue around representation, but that is not the only issue that affects a colony, right? We're looking at this from a very narrow lens of comparing two things that are not equal. These are highly unequal situations. To the extent that you want to diminish Puerto Rico's colonial nature to one of, well, if we just get representation in Congress, this will be solved, really misses what 119 years of U.S. colonialism has looked like beyond the 400 years prior to that of Spanish colonialism. But it diminishes this conversation to something that eradicates and erases that history.
I think it's also
and
important. Go ahead, Julio.
Yeah, I don't recall. Yeah, I don't recall, and not to diminish D.C., but people forget that there's been a history of violence in against nationalists in Puerto Rico. Look at Counter-Impro. Look at the FBI. Like, there's been a history of, like, repression of the United States on Puerto Ricans. And in the irony of all this is, while that was happening, Puerto Ricans go serve every major conflict in the United States and die for the right for people to call into, like, you know, 1A and say, like, I have an opinion. So I really think, like, that's sort of a slippery slope, because we can spend another 3 hours talking about, like, how Puerto Ricans have been oppressed under this system.
And, you know, it's actually interesting that you mention that, because, Julio, that dovetails perfectly into a voicemail we got in our inbox.
Hello, my name is Ben. I'm Puerto Rican. What I wanted the U.S. citizen from the mainland to know, in regards to every war that the U.S. have been involved with, the average Puerto Ricans would die more often than from any other states. Also, even though they choose to fight the country, they're not allowed to vote for president on this situation right now, to be able to make any decisions on their own that will affect their lives.
Ben, thanks for calling in with that. So yes, Julio, we certainly do take the point that there are plenty of Puerto Ricans who have served the country in the military. There's currently a Puerto Rican who is serving her country in the United States Supreme Court. So there certainly is an unequal equation in terms of what we get from Puerto Rico versus what we give. But I do want to focus for part of the rest of the hour, at least, on where we go from here, including some questions about the vote. Saul tweeted us, please note that prior to 2012 Puerto Rico plebiscites had a fourth option, none of the above. That got the most votes until 2012. Professor Benator Santiago, how do you think Puerto Ricans are thinking through the options for maybe something other than these three? Are these three options, modified territory, state, independent nation, are these three enough, or are the politicians at the top not listening to what the public really wants?
Well, the first thing, I think the model, the formula that we use to figure out what the status is needs to be revisited. In Puerto Rico, there's been a lot of debate for our constitutional convention where people can actually debate these issues, not just about checking a box with the wrong language. So that's one option. The second option, I think part of the challenge is understanding also what it entails to be an unincorporated territory. It means that Congress can cherry pick when it wants to treat it like a state, a sovereign nation, or something else. And that's created a lot of tension among sort of Puerto Ricans, because for some things, Puerto Rico is treated like a state. For other things, it's a foreign nation, and so on and so forth. So part of what's at stake is coming up with a formula that will allow Puerto Ricans to actually participate in a debate. The second part, the third part that I think we keep missing is that Puerto Rico would bring 7 seats to Congress, and based on electoral data, there would likely be Democrats. And the question is, why do Democrats in the United States continue to reject the idea of bringing 7 states? It's clear that Republicans will not accept reapportioning 5 seats and 2 senators to the Democratic Party. And there is no counter Republican state. D.C. Would be a Democratic state. But we need to figure out how this conversation can be part of a local dialogue that is connected to the U.S. dialogue. Of course, I favor independence. The question is, how can we move beyond institutions? But until we move beyond these sort of strategic formulas or ways of figuring out what the status is going to be, we're going to be in the sort of loop, at least for the next couple of plebiscites that are lined up.
Jerry tweeted us, there's no way that a Congress controlled by a party that demonizes Hispanics is going to allow Puerto Rican statehood. Ooh. Natasha, could I ask you what you think of just the political climate in Washington? I mean, our president did begin his campaign with a speech that said that Mexico is sending criminals and rapists across the border, and some, I assume, are good people. So that is part of the background here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any, I don't think that there's been any interest or taste to discuss this issue, and much less now. I mean, this is so far off the radar from what this administration is interested in, you know, from his campaign to what have now become fulfilled campaign promises that are extremely anti-immigrant, anti-Latino, anti-people of color. And we've seen how that's terrorized and affected the lives of millions of Latinos. I'm not sure that this current administration even distinguishes between the different ethnicities, or that, and there was a joke that wasn't that funny that Trump had said that, you know, Puerto Ricans were his favorite Mexicans. This idea that there's no interest, right, in allowing for more people from a very poor island whose first language is not English, whose culture is not this culture, particularly when we're talking about this kind of McCarthy-esque era litmus test of who's American and who's not American, and professing your your loyalty, as we saw yesterday with his cabinet meeting, to what it means, to what his ideal of Americanism is pretty scary. I'm not sure that there's that, and I'm not sure not only that there's no taste for this conversation right now, but also I don't know why this is, people believe that this is the political moment to push this issue with this particular administration.
Before we run out of time for the hour, Professor Cox Alomar, you are in Puerto Rico right now. What happens now that this vote has taken place? What has the government said the next step is? And is there already another plebiscite planned, or is this kind of going to be allowed to play out as intended?
Well, basically, the local government wants to push with the so-called Tennessee plan. They want to basically emulate what Tennessee did in 1796. I mean, and that's going to be rather uphill in Washington. They're going to send basically folks to Washington to push to be in basically sat in Congress. They're going to send perhaps six delegates to attempt to be seated at the House and two folks to be seated in the Senate. I mean, as happened in the case of Tennessee so many, many years ago. But that really doesn't, you know, that's gonna muster ridicule as opposed to any sort of support. I mean, before I leave, I just want to make sure that folks understand, I mean,
briefly,
there's an inaccuracy out there. I mean, statehood really hasn't won hands down anything, no plebiscite in Puerto Rico. I mean, statehood basically got 502,000 votes, but 80% of the folks registered to vote didn't show up because people realized that it wasn't a serious exercise. And the same thing in 2012, when you had 834,000 Puerto Ricans supporting statehood, but 900,000 Puerto Ricans voted either in blank or voted for something else.
Professor, I hate to cut you short. We got to let it go for this hour. Professor Rafael Cox Alomar of the University of District of Columbia, University of Connecticut Associate Professor of Political Science Charles Venator, Natasha Alicia Orav-Banan of Latino Justice ProDef, and Julio Varela of the podcast In the Thick. Thank you all for being with us. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.